Hello, and welcome to a MomsFightingAutism.com webinar. I'm your moderator this evening, Chantal Cecile Kira. I'm an author, and I'm known for providing practical strategies and hope to parents and educators. My guests this evening will be Cynthia Labre-Norell and Beth Wagner-Bruss, and I will tell you more about them in a minute. But I wanted to remind you all that if you want free information on adolescence, you can read my new column on the examiner.com newspaper, which is online, and I am the Autism and Adolescence Examiner. So you can just put in the search for that, or if you know how to spell my name, my last name is Cecile-Kira, Cicile-Kira. You're able to access my column there on examiner.com. So this evening, I'm happy to announce that I have two co-authors of a wonderful book that's called Quirky Yes, Hopeless No, Practical Tips to Help Your Child with Asperger's Syndrome Be More Socially Accepted. And they're here this evening to talk about social skills. So first of all, we have Dr. Cynthia Labre-Norell, who is a licensed educational psychologist, and she has specialized in the diagnosis and treatment of children and teens with Asperger's Syndrome for more than 20 years. As founder and clinical director of Comprehensive Autism Services and Education, Dr. Norell is an educational and behavioral consultant who oversees a team of therapists, social coaches, and group leaders. She's actually the founder of the Friends Club, which was launched in 2000 and which is discussed in Quirky Yes, Hopeless No. And she has created a safe and special place with the Friends Club where children and teens with Asperger's can come together in small groups on a weekly basis to learn social awareness and people skills. Based in Carlsbad, California, satellite Friends Clubs are now in Northern California and Hawaii. Dr. Norell lives in San Diego with her husband and two children. Beth Wagner-Bruss, who is the co-author, is an award-winning author of 13 children's books and articles published in the Los Angeles Times, Diego Union Tribune, and The Horn Book. A graduate of Stanford University, she has a son who is diagnosed with Asperger's Syndrome in third grade. Now a teenager, his social skills have noticeably improved by attending the Friends Club. This is the book that she wishes she could have had all this time. She lives in San Diego, California with her two sons and their noble but unpredictable dog, which I have actually run into on a few occasions, while walking my predictable assistance dog for my son, Jeremy. Welcome, Cynthia and Beth.
Hello.
Hello. It's nice to be here.
Okay, so before we get started with the millions of questions that have been sent in tonight, do you want to, Cynthia, just talk a little bit about your inspiration and what made you write this book with Beth called Quirky Yes, Hopeless No? Because I've been hearing about the book for quite some time now, and I think it's great that it's finally out.
Yes, my inspiration is really the kids that I'm lucky enough to work with and the ones that we've had in Friends Club. And actually, what we started when Beth and I got together to put the book together, we looked at the summaries, because each week we write summaries of what happened in the week with the kids. And we usually try to have some type of an anecdote and what we learned from them. And so when Beth and I were trying to put the book together, we started from those summaries. So they take us way back. A lot of those anecdotes are incorporated in the book. They're true stories of what the kids taught us as we were trying to teach them what we thought at the time were social skills, and we realize now it's so much more than that. It's social thinking, it's referencing, it's where your body is in space. There's so much more to what you're trying to teach them. And so the book is actually 5 years of working with these kids in this process. It's not meant to be a book that you take and you go, okay, now I know exactly what I need to do to go start a Friends Club. It's more meant you've got to understand where they're coming from and what parts that they're not quite getting that you need to teach is really what the focus of the book is meant to be. And it's meant to be have the humorous parts, because both Beth and I agree that you got to have some humor.
Absolutely.
As you're teaching the social thinking. And also it's meant to have some applicable suggestions and some strategies that we have found that have worked. Me and working with the thousands of kids that I'm lucky enough to work with, and Beth and working with her son and watching her son grow and change through this process as well.
And Cynthia, before I ask Beth a couple of questions, can you just tell me what got you started in the field of autism to begin with?
Well, I've always been kind of one that looks at those that are more difficult to understand. I started as a school psychologist and a bilingual school psychologist, Spanish-speaking, so I was working with, you know, that is it a language disorder, or is it because they speak two languages? And then I happened to be working in a small school district right about the time when the whole PDD, NOS kind of thing was coming out, and I was working in a preschool program looking at kids. It wasn't about whether or not they could speak. It was so much more, and that's when the whole advent of looking at the autism spectrum and that it is a large spectrum and that piece, and I just, it's just something that I have really enjoyed doing, and I find this population inspiring and challenging at the same time, and so I've been doing this now for 20 years.
Thank you. Now, I'm going to slow down because I've been told that I'm speaking too fast and people can't hear too well. So I guess it's the New Yorker in me. I guess I'll slow down to my California mode now. Beth,
yes.
Your son has been participating in the Friends Club under the auspices of Cynthia's organization for how long now?
Since fourth grade. He was diagnosed in third grade, and then he started in fourth grade when they had an opening. Yes.
Okay, and how old?
Yeah, and he's now going to be a senior in high school.
Wow.
So, you can do the math. I don't know. I'm not sure how many years. So enough years, and he's enjoyed it because it's always not. It's not always. There's some kids that carry over, and then there's always some new kids that start up in there. And he has had some friends over time. You know, they've come out of the Friends Club. But it's also helped him just have better social skills at his own school and in his neighborhood, you know, with other kids. And I've just noticed that when he's gone to, especially the high school that he's at now, for instance, when he had his full 100,000-mile tune-up IEP in ninth grade, the school psychologist's comment was that she was so impressed with his social skills, and that for an Asperger's kid, he was 2 to 3 years ahead of, you know, the 18 and 19-year-olds, you know, that weren't as advanced as he was. And she hadn't heard of the Friends Club, but she said, whatever you're doing, keep doing it, you know, that it really is noticeable.
Great. That's so wonderful to hear. Well, I'm going to start with some questions now. So this one's for Cynthia from Dana in New Milford. What can you do when your child tries to initiate play and the other children ignore them?
Well, I think one of the things that I've learned in the work that I'm doing is it's not a one-sided thing. It's not teaching all the skills to your child on how to initiate the play, but it's also being able to facilitate when other children are around to give meaning to some of the things that your child is doing. So I think it's important to be able to explain to them maybe why he's turning away. Oh, you know, it may be a little loud here, or, oh, he's trying to join in. He just needs you to ask him another time because he didn't hear you the first time, or whatever it is. And I call that social facilitation. So even within the group, a lot of times what we're doing with the kids is doing that facilitation, so there's giving meaning to the other children that are there as well. Not in a hovering, overly protective kind of way, but just in a natural way. There's some good resources on that. Come out of UCSD, Laura Schreiben's group on peer play, and there's some really good resources that can give you some examples of things that you can do with the peers to help them understand how to give a little bit more time for the child to respond, or how to respond to a child so that they're getting some of the feedback that they need to be so they're getting feedback
right
on what they could be doing.
And Beth, as a parent, what have you seen in terms of peers in regards to your son and trying to practice his social skills?
Well, I was going to say I've done exactly that without knowing that's what I was doing. Is I tend not to go too far away. I stay within earshot. Or if we're at a playground, for instance, early on I realized before Ben was diagnosed with Asperger's, that he was just that I needed to hang around, that he was unpredictable with other children, and sometimes even before his language was really there enough, you know, he might be too rough when instead of using his words, that kind of thing. So what I found was best also is that I'd sort of be there and just sort of sit on the curb, sit off the side of the sandbox, whatever. And if the kids were saying something to Ben and he didn't seem to get it, I'd sort of either talk to Ben and say, oh, did you hear that? Or ask them to do that exactly, repeat it or sort of interpret, you know, and just kind of be there to facilitate things, to bridge the gap that existed when he was younger. And then as he got older, I would be the one to ask him, Ben, why don't you invite someone over? You know, who would you like to invite from his class? And if he didn't know, we'd sort of go through the list as to who he thought he could have. Or if I had been volunteering at school, which I also tried to do, just so I could sort of see how the dynamics were within his classroom or within his grade level. If there was somebody who seemed like they were more patient or a quieter kid who would not be too loud for Ben or too, you know, physical, then I'd say, why don't we invite so-and-so? And then I'd you know, call the parent and ask if the kid could come over. And you need to initiate because I noticed that Ben wasn't one to say, gee, can I have so-and-so come over? That's not going to happen.
Exactly. And I do want to say that we're getting questions in from all different age groups, but I'm going to try and get right now some of the younger ones and then go up the age scale a bit.
That's a good idea.
So this one's from Diana T. in Charlton, Massachusetts. My son is 8 years old and experiences throughout his school year many headaches. He has a tendency to have high anxiety and stress in certain circumstances, and I believe the expectations and demands of the school day create the problem frequently. The nurse knows him well. I know ASPE kids are good at holding themselves together with an undeniable crash at some point in their day. My son usually gets them shortly after lunch or anywhere between 12 and 2. At this point, I have ruled out any physical and dietary reason, and during the summertime and school vacations, he is usually free of this problem. My question is, what types of therapies could I incorporate for him that will alleviate this issue, as well as any accommodation I can request to help him throughout his day? Thank you, and I look forward to this webinar.
Well, I think that there's some really accurate observations going on there, and I think that I'm hoping that somebody who has training in sensory integration, usually an OT, is possibly involved in your son's program so that you can look at what kinds of sensory strategies might help with the anxiety. I think anxiety is a big piece of a lot of what these individuals go through, and it can be a social anxiety, but it can also be just, like you say, having to be on for that period of time is just really the time limit. So is there something that he can do when you know he's getting to the end of that time that he can go have time to re-energize, just to pull himself back together, and that might be going into a library and spending some time alone in the library. Sometimes computer time will do this. I know we have to always look at limits to what I call screen time, but sometimes computer time will do that. Sometimes just reading or whatever it might be, to give him that time to decompress. We have a young man with Asperger's Syndrome that works in our company as a social coach and helps with the groups, and he says he often needs that time when he gets home just to decompress, and that for him, it's listening to loud music in a dark room. So it needs to be individualized, and oftentimes it can be set up by the occupational therapist. Doesn't mean that the occupational therapist always has to be there in order for your son to do his sensory activity, but usually that's somebody that can help direct you in that direction. There's a great resource, The Out of Sync Child by Carol Kranowitz, and she has some great examples in there of kids that get too overstimulated in the situation and need that time and some strategies on how to get themselves calm and regulate.
Great. Okay, here's a question from Carrie R. in Saginaw, Michigan. My son is 9 years old and has Asperger's. He has been receiving services through the school since he was an infant, speech, OT, and social work. However, we still cannot get him to want to socialize with kids his age. Anytime he is at a function or school, he gets very aggressive, either verbally or physically. What are we missing to help alleviate the anxiety of socializing with his peers? We have done everything that I know of, and even done the peer support or buddy system, which has also failed. He states he wants friends, but then will call them names or push, punch, etc. Can you suggest specific strategies or even a program that may help him? Please, I am at a loss.
Well, it sounds like part of what's going on is that there wasn't a step in between some of the real intensive work that was done when he was younger and being with typical kids. And if you look at kind of how I started Friends Club, I really did it with an emphasis in mind of bringing these kids together with similar interests and also similar wiring of the brain, or so to speak, other kids with Asperger's. And one of the things that I found that it did is it really did alleviate some of the anxiety that these kids have because they know they're different and they recognize their differences, and that creates even more anxiety because there's something that they can't quite measure up to. Tony Atwood does a really nice job of talking about how kids that have followed a particular developmental pattern from autism to Asperger syndrome, that they're always comparing themselves to neurotypical kids that are going to be thinking different than they are. So one of the things, one of the questions I have in my mind is, has there been any time spent on him working with other kids that are as articulate and as bright as he is, but also with some of the same social difficulties that he has, that he can possibly decrease some of that anxiety rather than saying, oh, no, we want him out working with his typical, or, you know, integrating with his typical peers. Looking at that as a beginning step. Oftentimes, and if you get a chance to read the book, oftentimes what I have found is if we start with that as a beginning step, especially for 9 to 14-year-olds, it gives them a chance to let that anxiety kind of dissolve a bit and be less anxious in that social setting and then much more successful with some typical peers.
And if I could add, it also, at least my experience here with Ben and as we say throughout the book, it really just takes one friend. It's not like these kids need to have a half a dozen or a dozen friends to feel good about themselves and less anxious. If we just find one kid who's of a like mind or at least understanding enough to that they can feel they can play together and have enough in common, whether it's Legos or music or some special interest, trains, you know, or planes or whatever, then they don't feel as alone. And again, I would think that makes them less anxious. I've noticed it with my son. He's less anxious because he knows he's got that one friend, and so he's not alone. And he can let go of kind of the rest of it.
Interesting. That's really a good comment. Okay, so this one's from Lesia in Carlsbad. Isn't that where you guys are located?
It is.
Unless it's Carlsbad, New Mexico.
Right. I don't know. It doesn't say here.
Yes.
My son is 5 years old, diagnosed. Uh-oh, and now I lost her. No, I'm sorry. I lost my place.
Well, find someone else and we can go back.
It's because there are so many here. I'm finding it. Okay. Here she is. I'm so sorry. My son is 5 years old, diagnosed PDD-NOS, but with a lot of Asperger's syndrome qualities. He is in a general education kindergarten class. He's currently fascinated by speaker systems and likes to create surround sound systems with whatever toys are at his disposal, Legos, blocks, etc. Well, I do not mind his interest in speakers and find it great that he creates his own systems. He usually hums or makes noises that he says are coming from his speakers. He usually hums loudly, and it can become annoying after just a bit. He will sometimes do this in public, and I wonder that he might do so in school when his friends are around. I do not want to make him feel badly about his behavior, but I'm trying to make him aware that there is a place and time to do this, mainly not during school as it could be disruptive. Any suggestions?
Well, I think that you bring up a good point, because if he's going to do that in school, and it's like Michelle Garcia Winters talks about, you know, they're going to have weird thoughts about him because that's different. I mean, I chuckle because I can just see this exactly happening for this little guy. But at the same time, I think it's important to understand that their special interests, such as this, provide some sense of calmness for them. So I wouldn't eliminate it altogether. So I like your idea of setting some parameters. What I love about the autistic spectrum is that you can set up some boundaries. You can do this here. It isn't appropriate to do here. And if he's as bright as it sounds like he is, he can understand the logic of that if you give him some reasons behind it. And then you also provide some time at home for him to be able to do those things in that safe environment where it's not going to make him stand out socially.
Right.
Social stories work great. I like them to be much more individualized, you know, not just taking a Carol Gray book and finding a social story about this and then copying it and saying this is for your son. You need to take the story and personalize it so it has more information in it specific to him. But that's a great start, setting up some rules for at home versus rules at school. They respond very well to visuals, so that's a good, that's why the social stories and setting up some rules really do help.
You know, this made me think of a question, because I know that some kids really like to help write their own rules and social stories, but what age is that usually common? Like, is 5-year-old pretty young for someone to be starting to help write their own rules?
No, I don't think so. I think it really depends upon the level of the kid, because of the child, because some, I think, can understand the logic and are quite articulate, and you can use that language, and that's the great part about their language. You can use that language to incorporate into a story that they see written by themselves. They've got buy-in into it. It's got their type of language in it, the way that they like to speak. So definitely you can do that with a 5-year-old. I've even done it with a 4-year-old. It just depends on the child.
Right, right. And Beth, do you have any comments to make about that, like as it pertains to your son, Ben?
No, well, just that again, what's great is they at least do have special interests, meaning they have a passion about something. And I think it's great to be able to use the strengths and play to those special interests, incorporate them to get through to them, you know. But the key thing is to just, obviously stay calm, be rational, not emotional, and making it a rule. The bonus is, fortunately, Asperger's kids are rule followers, and even if they object in the beginning, I've noticed with my son, they still will, if it's a rule, they'll follow it after that, as long as you're clear-cut and you've explained why, and it's all very calmly presented.
I think it's really positive that this parent is thinking about how, it is a positive aspect that he's able to build the speaker system, and so it's not that she wants to totally stop him from doing it, but she's saying he's got to learn that that's okay to do at home, but it's not necessarily something he should be doing at school.
That's
and
right.
That really makes it a lot easier for
mm-hmm.
the child.
Absolutely. I agree with you, Chantal.
Okay. I'm glad. I wouldn't want to say anything wrong on here. Okay, so lots more questions coming in. Here is one that's quite interesting. Nett Butler from Gillsville, Georgia. My son is 7 years old, and I'm finding it easier for children to be more accepting of him than the parents. I've talked to them and tried to help them understand a little more about how and why my son may do the things that they find not to be normal behavior. Sometimes I feel like he doesn't have friends because of the grown-ups. Do you have any ideas that may help us out with this?
Oh, that is an unusual question. I feel kind of sad for him. Parents or adults are supposed to be so much more accommodating.
Mm-hmm.
I think, there's a lot of stuff now out in the media. Beth and I were lucky enough to go to the premiere of Adam, which is a great movie about Asperger's. I think that if you can find something that, not just for you to be explaining, but something written, an article, a book, some type of a resource that they could go to that they could understand more about what this is and what it means when they do some of the things that they do, I think is really helpful. I think giving meaning, Barbara Doyle talks about making sense of what they're doing, why they're doing what they're doing, and possibly not trying to say, it's because he has Asperger's, but this might be what he means when this is happening, or this is what I've learned about him. One of my staff was explaining to a parent about the diagnosis, and the parent was saying, but he gets really emotional, and he pulls his sweatshirt over his head, and he goes under a table. And my staff was saying, but that's social, as well as being possibly sensory in nature. And the difference for your son, she was saying, is that when he goes under the table and pulls his shirt over his head, he's doing it because he's dealing with a sensory issue, but he's not thinking about what that's looking like to everybody else, where other kids might want to do that and don't necessarily do it. And I think the beauty of the movie Adam that I thought depicted this really well is it tried to give that explanation. It's not that they want to appear different. It's that they don't realize that that's making them appear different. And if that kind of an explanation could come out of the adults, I hope you can find more accepting adults.
Any comments, Beth?
Well, yes. I was going to say there were a couple of times in elementary school when, it was a birthday party kind of situation where I thought it was one Nick and it was really another Nick, you know, that had expressed an interest in having Ben come over or something. And when I told the one parent that, the look of horror on her face, like it couldn't possibly be her son that was going to be having Ben, you know, come over to play or be at a party, you know, I realized, oh, it's the other Nick. And she was sort of the first I'd run into that, though, which was interesting. But it's along the way. I could see there are certain adults that really couldn't handle the difference, you know. And I felt that if I could slowly sort of explain what was going on or subtly take it subtly from, you know, sidle up to them in a different way, then they'd go, oh, that's interesting. And I could see sort of lights going on for them then to realize, oh, quirky behavior, that's why. And once they knew why, then it was easier for them. But there's also, I think there is a social element the parents are thinking of is who is my child associating with and would it rub off on them or is this child, you know, the kind of child I want with my child, you know, that kind of thing. And they're already thinking about if they're going to Harvard or not. So, and that kind of person isn't going to appreciate the out-of-the-box thinker anyway. So who cares? It's their loss is how I looked at it. I didn't really worry about it.
Yeah, well, I had someone on this webinar a few months ago, and also I interviewed him in my book, Autism Life Skills, Brian King, who's a social worker who has Asperger's and has two children with Asperger's. And he talked a lot about how a lot of the social issues he had were not necessarily problems with learning social skills, but had to do with sensory issues.
Yeah.
And I was thinking that in response to what you said, Cynthia. And then the second thing I would like to share is he had this great idea because there were problems in his neighborhood with his kids. And so he realized that a lot of it had to do with ignorance, and so he wrote a really nice letter that he dropped off at everybody's house explaining that his kids had Asperger's, and he said the positive aspects of it, but then he also said how that might show in a behavior that they considered strange or quirky.
Yeah.
And he said the neighborhood totally changed because then the parents understood, because a lot of parents don't understand, and a lot of times it does have to do with information.
And what's so hard with Asperger's is that they just look like other kids. You know, I mean, it's not an obvious disability where you're in a wheelchair, you know, or you need a cane in order to get across the street. I mean, this is an invisible disability, and that's what Ami Klin has said at the Yale Children's Institute, you know, and he's an expert in Asperger's, is that it's a communication disability. And so here they are quite articulate. They're intelligent kids. And so people don't quite see, you know, why are they acting this way then? And they get, and I feel like, as you say, it's ignorance of not knowing why they're that way and not knowing about the Asperger's part of it. So then people resent them for it. Sort of like, why isn't that person snapping out? Why isn't that kid, you know, why are they being so defiant or stubborn or why, you know, quirky or whatever? And once you find out why and you understand what it's about, I see much more acceptance. I mean, that was the point of our whole book. I mean, I really feel that Cynthia and I are on this mission to try to have these kids be less misunderstood. They are so often misunderstood and then verbally abused, you know, because people get short with them and impatient and frustrated and why can't you comply and why can't you just go along? And they can't. They're wired to have their own perspective. They're wired to have to be rigid and inflexible because it's their viewpoint that's the only one they can see. So the whole thing is an education process, and that's why I was saying with these other parents that didn't seem to understand, if you can subtly sort of educate them without lecturing them, you know, then I think it comes across better, and they do end up more sympathetic and more welcoming.
Right. Really good points. I have a couple of questions here, and I'm sorry if I'm going to destroy or murder somebody's name, especially with the name that I have. I totally understand the difficulties, but I'm not an expert at name pronunciation. So this one's from Shilpa Ashtuputra from Ashburn. And here are her two comments and questions. Hi, I have a 6-year-old with high-functioning autism Asperger's. He loves numbers, So he gets stuck on numbers but fails to sense or understand others' perspectives. All the time we travel in the car, he is more interested in the mileage and also good at calculating as well. I try to divert him by changing the subject, but he manages that and goes back to his interests. This has been started a year back, although he is getting good at it, and it can be used to give him more inputs, but still it has turned into an obsession. Please, any advice would be welcome. This is an obstacle for him in interacting with other children and missing out on what's going on around him. And she also adds, is it common for an Asperger's child to do self-talking and totally not care what other people are talking about around them? And how do you address that issue?
These are two very good questions. And again, I think we talked earlier, and Beth also had chimed in on it. It's important, their special interests are important to them. It's what calms them. Also, interestingly enough, the special interest is what can decrease the sensory and social anxiety. Unfortunately, sometimes those special interests can make them stand out as more different. Here's what I would do. I would use his special interest to try to teach something in regard to the social behavior, especially because he likes numbers and adding numbers. I would try to come up with some type of an equation. Like even in Friends Club, one of the things I did way back early on was a formula for a conversation was a question plus a comment plus a compliment, to try to teach almost in a concrete mathematical equation a social skill. If we can find some ways to do that, again, going back to what I was saying earlier, though, with their special interest, also limiting for him, okay, in the car doing your numbers is okay, possibly not if it's an eight-hour-long trip, but talking about numbers for a certain amount of time is okay, and then we're going to stop and we're going to go on to something else. And we do address that in the book on how to stop the incessant questions and stop some of the things they want to repeat over and over again by having some type of a visual or actually some type of an activity of, okay, we're going to put the numbers in a drawer and we're shutting the drawer. Numbers are done for right now. And amazingly, these kids respond very well to that because it's concrete, away, done, and then you let them come out at another time when you know, it's a more appropriate time.
And if you're traveling, just a small box, Cynthia used that as an example as well, that you're pretending you take that topic, you're putting in the box, you close the box, okay, that topic is done, and they can't argue with the box. That's what's fascinating.
Maybe I should start trying to do that with my neurotypical 17-year-old female.
Good luck.
I love some of these techniques for Asperger's. I just come home and try them on my neurotypical child and hope they'll work too. Because they can be when they're in teenagers, right?
Right, right. And the second part of the question was about
the self-talking.
It is very typical to do the self-talking. That is very typical. Part of it is helping them to process the information. It's their way of trying to remember what it is they're hearing auditorily, because a lot of kids on the spectrum are not auditory learners. They don't remember things because they've heard it. They remember things because they've seen it. And so one that's using a lot of self-talk is because that's his way of trying to process the information. Again, socially, it can be very inappropriate, especially if they're in a classroom or it's, you know, getting in the way of other people having conversations. One of the things that we've done with kids that will self-talk is teach them quiet talk or in-my-head talk, because they're not often aware that they're talking out loud.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. And it's worked. It takes a little bit of time, but it definitely has worked. And again, if he's as bright as he sounds as he is, social stories also help for that as well.
What kind of a social story then, Cynthia? I mean, what would an example?
Well, a social story would be...
For self-talking, for instance.
Yeah. For self-talking is when I'm talking out loud and others can hear me. That's when it's disruptive or annoying to others. When I'm able to talk within my head and keep the information within my head, then it isn't as annoying to other people. And that logic in there, and then practicing it, and then using a little reminder. Remember, you should be talking, you know.
And you could point to the head, maybe, and point to the head to remind them.
Absolutely. And I don't do a whole lot of stop doing that, stop the self-talk. I do more of, think in your head. You know, have your thoughts in your head.
Mm-hmm. Okay, here's a question.
Oh.
I'm sorry. Did you have something more to say?
Well, yeah, something else that's in the book that, that gets repeated over and over, because in the book we also know that people won't, the book was not designed to read straight through, because no one has time to read books anymore almost, but it's designed to be whatever the issue is, then that's what you go to, whether it's bullying, rudeness, compliance, teasing, you know, whatever. It's, they're all short chapters in and of themselves. But because of that, we also repeat ourselves in the book, because we don't know where people are going to read. And what she was just talking about, what Cynthia was just talking about was that, and I've lost it. Never mind. It was something about how, trying to remind them, and having to continue to just
have
point out, you know, to have little signs, concrete examples of to remind them of what their behavior is. And it's amazing how quickly then that can become a short code. A little message to let them know, and it works. And even the fellow that Robinson, who wrote that book, you know, Look Me in the Eyes, he says his wife just comes along and gives him a little nudge with his with her elbow, and then he knows, oh, I'm talking about tractors too much, you know.
Mm-hmm. You have this code. I see.
Yes.
Interesting. Okay, here's a question from Annette in San Diego. Hello, my son has PDD NOS and is 7. I was wondering what your opinion would be if I were to videotape my son playing with others and play it back to him so that he can see how he acts, or do you think I should videotape typical kids and show him that? I'm trying to see which avenue would show a more positive result when playing with others. Also, do you think it would upset him if I show him how he acts, i.e. repeats a lot of questions, doesn't move on to the next subject, gets upset when he doesn't win, etc.?
I love the idea of videotaping. I call it video scripting. I think it's a great idea, and what I recommend, and I use it myself in therapy that I do with kids, is that videotape him doing appropriate things, what you want him to do. So you got to catch him, you know, that moment when it's a perfect social interaction, and play that back. There's a couple of reasons why you want to catch that versus what you don't want him to do. The video replays in their head. Adults with Asperger's tell me all the time that they go home and there's a video that's in their head. Temple Grandin talks about it. So you want them to be replaying a video of something you want them to be doing rather than what you don't want them to do, because it's almost like getting that tape recorder of them saying the thing you don't want them to say. The other piece is they love watching themselves. I mean, a little bit about the autism is they're kind of stuck in that egocentric stage. And so oftentimes they really like seeing the video. So if you do get a really good clip of the social, or you set it up as a script and your son can read, you can set up a whole script. We talk about this in the book as well. You can set up a script, and then they're reading the script and they're performing the action that you're hoping to get. You get that on the video, you copy that several times on the same video clip, and they watch it over and over again, and what you're actually doing is helping them to see themselves be successful, and it turns into an appropriate social behavior. It's a great idea. I think the second step after that, after he watches himself on video, would be to capture some kids doing some things that you can stop the video and ask the question, you know, what do you think happened here? What was going on here? But I would do it with him first. And then if you want to do it with other kids, or you can use movies, Michelle Garcia Winter has that as a strategy. I've used it in Friends Club where we stop a movie and we ask, okay, what just happened here? What was successful? What didn't work? That's a great strategy.
Good. These are really good tips for the listeners.
Yeah, and one other great question. These are great ideas from your listeners. They're great.
Can I just speak of the one thing that I was trying to get at before when I was saying we repeat ourselves throughout the book and certain things, and that thing was, and it's what Cynthia just brought up again, which we can't emphasize enough, is that with Asperger's kids, you need to tell them what you want them to do, not tell them what you don't want them to do. Because just telling them what you don't want them to do leaves them completely flummoxed, you know, then they're baffled. And they can't intuit what it is you're getting at. And I'm assuming, Cynthia, that's why the social stories are so effective, is because you are telling them what to do. And then it makes it absolutely clear, and so there is no guesswork involved, because it just isn't going to help them to tell them what you don't want. Then you just get this blank stare, and then they're stuck. Well, what is it then? You know, what should I do?
Absolutely.
Interesting. Here's a question Many people have asked this type of question, so I'm going to read this person's, but a lot of people have been asking this type of question. Maria Duke in Hanover asks, how can I, in my position of a parent or a child on the spectrum, help and or convince a teacher, or I would even say a school district, of the importance of inclusion and the need for them to be more involved in facilitating the interaction between children? Because I've heard, I mean, my child does not have Asperger's, but, you know, in my position in helping in the community and advocating, I hear so many times stories of these kids who have all this help or, you know, they can pull it together during the classes, so they don't have aid support or there's no inclusion specialist there during, say, those downtimes like recess, which is a social time.
Exactly.
So how do you go about educating a teacher or a school district?
Well, I think this is a very important question. I don't think it's easy to answer all at once. I think there's a lot of resources on inclusion. There's a lot. I think it's always good to get some data and some research when you're trying to take something to a school district or a teacher. You know, they want to know, okay, well, what's backing this up?
Right.
Although I think parents, and I tell teachers this all the time, a parent of a child with an autism spectrum disorder has done more research for more hours than any of you will ever have done because of the amount of effort and, I think, motivation to find out as much as they can. But one of the things that I think that we need to also understand is that autism, one of the three features of the diagnosis of autism is a social disability. And in the federal regulations and I know in the state of California regulations, that's a unique need. And that is what I like to go in when I'm in an IEP meeting and I'm talking about the social facilitation, the recess time, like you say, Chantal. That's when the child needs to be supported, not just in the classroom time, is looking at what are the unique needs, how have we written their present levels of performance to indicate that so then we can get that support at that time, which is the jungle called recess.
Right. Any comments, Beth?
Well, just that again, as parents, if you're able to volunteer at your child's school, I think that's huge in a couple of ways. One, again, it allows you to see what the dynamic is, and if you could help it at recess, be a yard duty or help at lunchtime, you know, to monitor, then you can see what's going on, and you're better able to help your child maybe and smooth the way. If you get to know the other kids and they know that you're so-and-so's parent, you know, and you can find common bonds. I've found common interests from other kids that my son never would have discovered they had, and it makes them then reach out more to them and be able to connect, and then that helps, you know, just in general. And then the other thing is, that if you help at the school as well, I've found that the people who are offering the services then, when you come to ask for services, they're much more willing to help because they know you're there for them and it's a reciprocal sort of thing. And it's not just, you know, you're coming saying, you've got to do this for my kids. If you're also there to help not just your child but the rest of the school in other ways and be active as a parent, then it's more of a give and take, you know, and it just seems to smooth things out.
That's really great, but I would have to say, too, though, there are many, many parents that cannot afford to have or do not have the jobs. Like, you're a writer,
exactly.
Like I am.
Right.
So even though we need to work, we can get up and write at 3 o'clock in the morning. But many people have a job where they have to be somewhere. Like, if you're a cashier and you have to be somewhere at 9 o'clock till 4 o'clock, there's no way you can volunteer at your school during those hours. So those are great suggestions. I don't want people who are listening to feel guilty about the fact that they have a job that keeps volunteering at school.
I just want to add on here, and being a working parent myself and working lots and lots of hours with lots of wonderful kids, one of the things that I always did to support my school, my kids' school, is the outside kinds of things that you can do. Like, for example, this parent might get a copy of Tony Atwood's book or a copy of our book.
Can you please? I'm sorry, someone had emailed in while we were talking, and that was going to be my next question. What is the name of that book you suggested from Tony Atwood?
It's called Asperger Syndrome. It's his first book.
Okay, so is that the book you have been suggesting every time you talk about Tony Jeremy Atwood's book?
Well, he's got a couple of different books up, but I like that one in particular because I think it's an easy read for teachers. If you hand too much to a teacher to read as a resource, they're going to put it on their bookshelf and not look at it. But if you find articles, short articles, that are good about Asperger's, I've got a couple of different ones that I mention on my website, or the book, Tony Atwood's book, or even possibly our book, or some other book that is going to give them some information that they can read, and it's not just going to come from the parent. I know many of the parents that I work with, actually each year they prepare a little care package for the teacher receiving their child, and it's got resources in it, information, possibly if their child needs fidgets, different kinds of things for the classroom. And that, like Beth was saying, and it's that way of making a presence in a positive way, not you will do this for my child, not that
right.
I think all parents do that, but it's all in the presentation. When I heard this question, I think about the teachers that I have to meet with sometimes. And sometimes I want to go out the door and just go, oh my gosh, is it worth it? But other times I think, you know what, if I can keep presenting the way this child's thinking, yes, it is a disorder, but it's a difference. It's a different way of thinking. And if I can get them to think like this child is thinking, and if I can get them to understand that social piece, how much better, not just for my child that's going to be in that program or my client that's going to be in that program, but how much better for other kids coming along. And I always say to the teacher, that says to me, I've never had a child like this before. I say, oh, there's many more behind them.
I've always found it's useful. I mean, it doesn't matter whether your child has Asperger's or autism or whatever disability, but especially because the Asperger's is an invisible disability, it is so important, is to just write a one-page note. And I say one page because the teachers have so much. That goes in the first day of school. Positive thing about your child, but also might explain a couple little things so that the teacher right away gets it, you know, or at least gets an idea that there's, you know, something great about this kid, and then there's something she's not going to need to help him with.
Yeah. And in our book, in fact, it's on page 313, I'm looking at it. It's titled A Sample Email from Parent to Teacher at the Beginning of the School Year. And it's mine. I mean, it's the one I've sent for the last 5 years now to middle school and high school teachers via email for Ben's teachers at the beginning of the school year or beginning of each semester if that's a new start with new teachers. Because I actually wait to I don't do it the first day because I think it's nice if they can just see what Ben's like without me saying anything. And in fact, Ami Klin, we quote him in our book because he had this wonderful phrase where he said, there was one of his patients or clients who had said, you know, I love the first day of school. And Ami asked him, well, why? And he said, because no one knows yet.
Right.
And that's so effective. That's so powerful, you know. And so what I do is I wait actually till the Friday of the first week of school because I figure, you know, there's enough going on in the first week and everybody's getting to know each other fine. And not too much can go wrong usually in those first few days. And by Friday, I open it saying, hi, I'm Ben Brust's mom, and I want to thank you for a successful first week of school for Ben. Because it always has been, or it's close enough, you know. And then I say, he likes school, and I say these positive things. And then I say, by the way, you may have noticed, you know, that he's a bit quirky or whatever. Well, he has Asperger's and he has ADD. And then I go into these are the things. He has an IEP, but you may not have gotten the paperwork yet. But these are the things that would be that he has allowed for modifications and accommodations. And I list, you know, five things that would help him by sitting closer to the front of the classroom so that he can concentrate better. If he starts to seeming like he's getting too anxious or going to have a meltdown, send him out into the hallway. If that's not calming him enough, let him go to the school psychologist. And every teacher has been incredibly grateful. I mean, all of them seem to respond. They're all so glad. They're happy that Ben is intelligent. They're happy he wants to participate. And they're very grateful to me. Most of the time, they thank me so much for just letting them know. And anything that we can do, let's work together. And what my previous comment about saying when you volunteer, and they only want you to volunteer really in elementary school. They want you less to volunteer in secondary, you know, in middle school and high school. But that doesn't mean you can't still establish a sense of teamwork with your child. That's what I like to do, is to try to let the teachers know they're not alone, and I expect them to fix my child or help my child, whatever, without me. I feel that they are that much more grateful, and I'm grateful to them, and we work better if there's a sense that we're a team, you know, working on this together. And I let them know I'm helping Ben at home after school to keep him on track, to make sure, you know, check his homework, make sure things get done. And then I just, you know, I want them to let me know if there's anything happening in the classroom, because Ben doesn't always tell me. There are many things that he can get upset about during the day, but by the time the last class has come along, he may have forgotten it because other things have happened. So the teachers, that's helped them open the door to let them know they can tell me if something's not working, you know, and we can go back and forth. One other thing I just wanted to say is that even in as young as in elementary school, the library was a sanctuary for my son, for Ben. When things would get too up, he'd get too upset either socially or just the stimulus or whatever, he could go to the library during lunch or at recess, and the librarian was wonderful at his elementary school in just saying hi, you know, welcoming him, you know, letting him just sit there, or maybe giving him something to do that was easy to take his mind off it or whatever, you know. But it was just another place. And in middle school it was huge, because it middle school, it doesn't matter where you send your child, it's the phase of the children, it's not the facility, it's not the school itself, it's just that age where they're, it's kind of like shark infested waters at lunchtime, and they don't have PE, you know, or recess rather, they just have that one long lunch hour. And so I encouraged Ben to go to the library, because I had volunteered at the middle school library and I could see all the other Bens in there. There were lots of ASPE kids who were all hiding out, you know, or the socially immature kids. And it was this wonderful, welcoming, safe place in the library. And inevitably, the librarians were terrific at knowing these kids, you know, wanted to be there, and they'd play their Yu-Gi-Oh cards, or they'd play other cards, or chess, or they'd just sit and talk, or they'd be on the computer. But it was a way for them to avoid, you know, some of the social nightmares that can happen in middle school.
Okay, we have tons of questions. We're going to keep moving here. I want to address one more question about teachers before moving along. This is Kim Spencer from Savannah, Georgia. What can we tell our teachers to do on the playground, Cynthia, to facilitate our children's inclusion?
One of the things we need to tell our teachers to do is to be out there on the playground, see what's going on with the kids. I mean, there's many times I've been in meetings and I said to the teacher, well, do you know what's going on the playground? Well, no, because that's when I have my break time, and I appreciate, I'm married to a teacher myself, but I appreciate that they need their break time, but they need to be out there observing a few times so they can see what's going on. There's something that maybe they can model in the classroom, or they can talk about, not pinpointing that particular child in the classroom setting, but they can be modeling things for the kids on how they can be getting along with each other out on the playground. The other thing is, if they are out on the playground, they can facilitate by, one, oftentimes if there's an adult around, that child's not going to be targeted to be bullied if there's an adult around. And that's, I think, huge for a lot of these kids, the bullying component. I think the other piece is they can facilitate and help have more structure. Oftentimes what happens at recess time is that there's a lack of structure, so they're not really sure how they're supposed to step in, how they're supposed to join in, and sometimes when they do, they muddle it all up. And so the facilitation that goes on from the adult is to add some structure to a game, adding some structure to some of the rules, by adding in rules, and then if they see what's going on out there at recess time, when they're in the classroom, they can be practicing those types of things.
Good. Now, Lisa from Collinsville has asked a very interesting question here. She's in law enforcement, and she says that in taking 911 calls, she's seen an increase in calls that involve high-functioning autistic children. My officers are not very knowledgeable of these types of children and young adults and not very understanding. Any suggestions for training for law enforcement on how to deal with autistic children?
Well, there are resources. There, I know the Autism Society of America has a whole training for law enforcement officers and people in law enforcement that are going to encounter these kids. So that's first. I mean, I want to say there's a lot of resources out there. There's videos, there's training videos. I've seen some of these. I think the main thing is to try to explain again, I think the whole presence of this webinar tonight has been talking about understanding where they're coming from first, because a lot of times what they're dealing with, and when you're in law enforcement and you're dealing with a reactive behavior, you're most likely dealing with sensory overload. And that's what you're seeing, and it can be interpreted. You know, law enforcement is taught to look at, is this aggressive behavior and what am I going to do about it? Because it is aggressive behavior. When you're dealing with a child with high-functioning autism or a person with Asperger's syndrome, you're not necessarily dealing with aggressive behavior in terms of that child intends to harm somebody. They're trying to deal with that sensory, almost a physical pain that they're dealing with. And I think that is key for people to understand, is it's not about this kid trying to hurt me. It's about them dealing with that and that sensory issue. I think it's important for them to ask questions. You know, if they're seeing some behaviors and they can understand a little bit more about autism and be educated a bit, and they can ask some questions when they're seeing some behaviors, that can go through their head, maybe this is what we're dealing with. I mean, there's a great scene in the movie Adam.
Exactly.
And it's just, I think, so much what these kids deal with. And, you know, he's outside watching a school of kids, and just because of his stance and his awkwardness, the police drive by and they interpret and assume something that's totally wrong. And they attack him and they, you know, pin him up against the fence. And it's so poignant, I think, of what a lot of my clients, my adult clients, have gone through, actually.
And in the movie, he had just lost his job. So he was already bereft as it was, you know, and yet he wouldn't know to tell them that because
exactly.
He's Asperger's, you know. And that's the key thing, is so often with these Asperger's kids, you need to, they do something, and we have our perception, but we need to ask why. Because so often you'd never suspect the reason they're doing what they're doing. It just wouldn't occur to us because we're not wired that way. And so I've learned asking my son why, you know, helps me to keep from getting upset or keep from thinking he's being defiant. And really, it's just a completely out-of-the-box kind of thing. And then I'm able to go, okay, and rationally explain why that's not such a good idea right now, or we don't do it because that's inappropriate or whatever. But my understanding is that teachers are actually taught, and probably officers are taught, not to ask why, you know, because that opens up a can of worms, I guess, to be told all sorts of stories, you know, and you wouldn't get to the truth, sort of. You just want compliance. But again, Asperger's kids struggle with compliance because
officers have to be very careful because they're not allowed to question people. I mean, you have to be careful with the Miranda rights and all that kind of stuff. So it is kind of a can of worms,
yes.
I guess.
Definitely.
So, okay, let's move on here. I am going to talk about more of the questions about the teens that have been coming in, but I did want to say that we are getting tons and tons of emails here from people asking about social coaches and doing, for example, the Friends Club in other places. So, for example, here's Donna in Houston. Are there any social coaches for teens in Houston?
That's a good question. Houston's not an area that I know a lot about. I do know that Texas has some great services in certain areas. Those kinds of questions about specifically is it being done in the area, I recommend that you email me or my staff, and we try to get back to you if we find out about information in those areas. The other thing that you can also, another great resource, is every state has an Autism Society of America chapter in different areas of your state, and that's a great resource to try to find people that do social thinking groups.
Mm-hmm.
Michelle Garcia Winner's website is a good website. It's www.socialthinking.com. Michelle does a lot of training of people from across the United States, so she knows where certain social thinking groups are going.
So are you planning to take the Friends Club nationally and go around and start doing training on the Friends Club?
Well, I already have Friends Club in a lot of different places. It's in Canada, up in Vancouver, in the Sunshine Coast, in Northern California, and Hawaii, and here in Southern California. So, yeah, I mean, there's always a potential.
Okay. So people could contact you about that, correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the website is www.cynthianorell.com. It's my book website. And specifically about where we're doing Friends Club is on www.casefamily.com. And that's where I would direct more questions about, you know, are you doing in this area? Do you have information about Friends Club in my area? Because that's where I can really direct some of my staff to help me answer those types of questions.
I think it'd be good if you spelled out Cynthia Norell because of the R's and the A's and the L's and all that. So.
Okay, so it's Cynthia, N as in Nancy, O-R-A-L-L.com.
Okay. Now, before I move on to answering some of these team questions, there were many people who asked about anxiety and stress. For example, Jeff from Saginaw, what do you suggest for a child who is 9 years old with Asperger's and acts out under stress or when they get anxious?
Well, I think with anxiety and stress, you're talking about a sensory issue. And I think you've got to get to the bottom line of what that sensory issue is. We have something in our company called the behavior pyramid. And at the bottom of the behavior pyramid is the sensory. And we talk about all the different things that could possibly be going on. When you're dealing with high anxiety and or you're dealing with a child who's very, very controlling, you're probably dealing with high anxiety. But I don't know exactly what that is unless I were to observe and give some recommendations based on those observations. Again, a really great resource is The Out of Sync Child by Carol Kranowitz, and it's available online, Amazon.com. It's got some good information in there. And I do think that Michelle Garcia Winter has some information on dealing with the social anxiety as well and how to alleviate that and coming up with some of the strategies that I've been talking about earlier in this webinar.
Great. Okay. I'm going to start here with some questions about teenagers because we certainly have a lot of those besides younger years. I'm not saying I'm not going to go back to the other ones, but I thought I'd start. Actually, here I'm going to start with someone who is 15. This is from Lucille Carlos Beckenridge in Riverside, California. My grandson is 15 and has good verbal skills but socially is quirky. He does not know when to stop talking and will stop strangers to converse with them. Adults often show compassion for him and will allow him to speak, but children his age look at him with disdain. He has no friends. How can I find a support group where his parents and I could arrange playdates with other children like him? He lives in Riverside.
Well, again, there would be an Autism Society chapter in the Riverside area. In addition, I would also get in touch with, I know there's autism support groups in that area because it's not too far from where I am in San Diego. There are support groups in the Temecula area, so I would especially look in that area. Another great resource if you're out here on the West Coast is Valerie's List, which Chantal, you know about, and she often has information about the Riverside area in her website, and it's valerieslist@aol.com.
In fact, you can actually send her an email asking her to post in there, in her Valerie's List, is there one in this area or are people interested in having one? And people will respond to you through that. All you have to do is email Valerie at valerieslist@aol.com to say you want to receive her list, and then you can for free post in her list.
Yes, and I think that's a great way to find a specific support group. I know the Autism Society of America has a chapter in that area. And also another great resource, too, is to find out from school psychologists or speech and language therapists in the area if they're doing any of the social skills groups.
Exactly. That's what I was going to suggest, because I know at my son's high school, and they even did it at his elementary school, the school psychologist was the lead person to pull together certain kids, either of the same grade level or within two grades of each other, pull them together, and you know, once a week or every other week, you know, just for an hour to have them meet and talk, and they'd via playing games or when they were younger, and then as older, they sit at, you know, in a circle. They were able to talk, you know, and feel again less alone, and they seem to work on improving their skills that way.
Okay. Here's someone who writes in, how do I teach my 20-year-old high-functioning autism daughter to explain her linear thinking and her sensory issues to others around her? She has also expressed a need to ask for time away when on the verge of a meltdown. She doesn't know how to do it. please help. She wants to know how to do this independently. In other words, she doesn't want to need prompting from another person. Thanks in advance.
Okay, so if I'm understanding correctly, she's not asking to get to have time away when she's about on the verge of a meltdown, but she's asking for help on how to do that independently?
Right, which leads me to believe if what I'm understanding from this question is she recognizes when she already has that self-awareness, which is really the first important step. So that's really how to tell people that she's on the verge of a meltdown or how that she needs to get away or she needs a break.
Well, I think a really important step to put in here is to have a cue from the parent, like we were talking about earlier, just a cue that she can read that means I need to go step away, because then what she can start linking is what she's feeling or what's going on sensorily right before that's about to occur that allows her to do that. So if she's asking for the help, I would just use it as, okay, now we just need to teach you a cue. When I do this, that's what it means, and not necessarily getting in there and saying, okay, now it's time to go take your break away. It's just I've got the cue to do that.
No, but she wants to give that cue to other people independently. Like, she wants to be able, if she's in a situation.
Well, you want to, right, she's 20 years old. So one of the things I want to be careful of is I want her, I also want to teach her as a strategy, if she's going to give that cue to somebody, that she's got to give it to somebody that she trusts so that it's not something that's going to be used against her. So, and some work with her is sitting down and developing a list of those that, you know, can be loyal friends and those that I may not mention the cue to, and give her that type of a list and tell her why certain people are going to be in the list versus one list over the other. And then for her to just practice ways to go up and tell, you know, to tell that person in a private way, not out loud in front of everybody, hey, if you see me start to get where it looks like I'm going to have a meltdown, please give me this cue. I mean, it's lots of great ways. I mean, if she were in my office, I think that with the amount of awareness that she has, I could probably teach her in a couple of sessions.
But so, Cynthia, would this be a case of the cue is almost an interim measure, so that it's another bridge, Chantal, of her, you know, she knows she needs to leave, and then the cue would just be that visual sort of concrete thing to make her be aware, okay, oh, that's how I'm feeling, I need to leave. And it's only for a few times or maybe a month or two, and then eventually she won't even need the cue at all. And that's kind of what we've, you know, throughout the book, we keep trying to, remind parents and teachers and grandparents, whoever reads the book, that nothing, it all needs to be broken down into smaller steps.
Yes.
With the Asperger's people, there's hope because they can learn these social skills. They just need what we take for granted actually are many smaller, would be broken down into many small steps, and each one of those steps takes a while, and this cue would be one of them, but then eventually you don't even need that. You know, it becomes a smooth transition, but it just takes a while to learn it.
Right. Yeah, good thoughts. Okay, here's Donna Anton from Houston. Her son is 18. He was diagnosed with nonverbal learning disorder, but NLD and Asperger's seem very similar to me. At home, Max, while not the life of the party, is funny, fun and entertaining, incredibly pleasant and clever. But at school, he's always just hovering around the edges of groups, never entering in. He would come home with stories of funny things that happened or that people said, but for the most part, he was just observing other people. He's volunteered at the museum every summer for 5 years, often with the same kids. This past summer, his life of the party brother volunteered as well, and Max came home saying he wished he knew how to become a part of the group the way his brother does. He just doesn't know how. Listening to him try to make small talk is painful. Though we live in a big city with one of the biggest medical centers in the world, Houston, I've yet to find any real help for social skills for my incredibly dear son. I don't need any more help understanding his struggles. I need help giving him the skills to overcome these social structures. Thank you. Or these social struggles.
Well, the easiest part to explain of all of that is that nonverbal learning disability and Asperger's are basically one and the same. So it's the different lens that you look at when you're coming up with a diagnosis, but that's a whole different answer and goes into a different set of questions. The fact that she's from Houston and has been searching out for some help with these social skills tells the other listener that maybe we do need some help in Houston with a friends club. I think it's important. I think your point is, I think you've got a very good point. It's like you understand, but how are you going to help him? And I think the main thing is for motorcycles just went by my window, but that I think one of the first things that you need to do is get a copy of our book. I think there's a lot of really good strategies and ideas in there on how to help. The other thing is we need to get your son connected to other kids like him.
Mm-hmm.
That he's able to point out and be aware of how different he is, especially then his brother comes along and the things that are happening there. I think we need to find him some kids that have have similar interests and have some connection there so he can feel successful socially. That's key.
And that's the thing. If he has a special interest, if there's something that he really likes, then, like, my son likes books. So in the summertime, I've had him go volunteer at the library, and then he's met some other kids who also at least like to talk books, you know. And for the Lego connection thing, you know, he still likes Legos, even though he's, you know, 18. And he's thought of starting a Lego club at the high school. And at first I was rather worried about it, yeah, because I'm thinking, oh, man, other teenagers aren't going to understand. But then I realized there are other kids like Ben who would enjoy playing if you can make it a fun thing how you do it. So you can use the special interest as a way to connect to somebody. I feel bad how painful it is to hear him try to make small talk. As you say, Cynthia, in our book, and what you teach at the Friends Club is a lot of just breaking down what is small talk. It's the greeting. It's the, you know, you say something and then you ask someone something else. The Asperger's kids just often don't think to ask anybody anything. They don't ask the questions that can start a two-way conversation. They just kind of deliver information and keep going on because they like it, you know, to talk about what they want to talk about. And so that small talk is painful, but what helps is the practice of it. And it is possible. I've heard my son, you know, ask other kids questions. And he didn't used to, and with practice, he did. And that's what's, again, it's breaking down what we all take for granted, you know, in something as small as small talk. And there's still all these tiny elements that they have to learn as to, you know, make the eye contact if they can, and then ask the question, wait and listen for the answer, and then try to build on the answer back and forth. Right, Cynthia? I mean, it's that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Right. Well, it's interesting because that person seemed to be somebody who understood that he was different and really wanted to know how to be able to be more social. But I have a letter here from someone, Linda, in Livonia. It's more as if this person appears to not really care about being socially included, or at least he acts that way. My 14-year-old son starts his first year of high school in a few weeks. His middle school years were not very successful, socially speaking. He is very smart, but usually doesn't apply himself. He will receive very good academic support at the school, and they try to help him socially. However, he is so negative and anxious about going. Anything specific I should be doing, saying he seems annoyed with most words of encouragement I have for him. Should I force him to join a club? He says he's not interested in any of them. I'd like high school to be a more positive experience than his past few years have been. How do you deal with that with people who, and I know it's, some of it may have to do with past experiences that were negative, but how do you help someone who's in their teens have a positive attitude and want to be more socially included?
Well, if he were here in my office, I would challenge him behaviorally because that's what I am. I'm a behaviorist, and I would say I really don't think it's that you don't want to have friends. I think it's that you haven't been successful, and we've got to find a way to help you be successful. I know one of the things that the gentleman that works for us that I diagnosed at 15, and he's now almost 25, has told me that was the most powerful thing for him as a teenager, well, prior to being a teenager too, was that his mom, I don't want to use the word forced because we don't want to put him into social, but she set it up that his work was he had to go to things that would cause him to be social. Like he had to join certain kinds of clubs, and it was his mom that really kind of put it out there. This is the rule. You've got to join the band. And that was the best thing that he did. He was very musical, from a very musical family, and it was the best thing that he did was being in the band at the high school. And it was his connection to other kids that had a similar interest. Some of them just as quirky as he was, and it was his connection, and it turned into his social group. And even now at 25, he tells me sometimes, you know, I'm too much of a social butterfly. I've got to, like, calm down here, you know. So I think it's important to look at, it may feel like you're forcing, but setting up as this is the rule. Before you have your video games, this is what you have to do. First, you have to go to, you know, join this club, and then you can come home and veg with your video games. Because it's not going to be in his nature to seek that out. He's going to rather isolate and withdraw. And again, a cognitive behavior therapist like myself working with him is going to say, I think what you're trying to say is this is too hard to do and you need some help, rather than, no, it's okay, you can really do it. It's kind of coming at it in a different way, challenging a little bit more. I have 14-year-olds that walk in here and they, you know, they have their arms across their chest and their mom says, well, I'm here because, you know, we're interested in being in the Friends Club. And the first thing they say is, I don't need to be here. And the first thing I say,
right,
well, I think you do. And sounds that way. And I always say, you know, we got to make a deal. You got to come not just one time, but you got to come for a few sessions. And once they're here and they see that there's other kids like them, they're the ones knocking on the door to get in. So don't be discouraged.
Okay, here's more of kind of the same. Della Nelson Torrance. My son does very well in school except for socially and comes home full of anxiety. The teachers love him because he is so quiet and follows every rule. Doesn't this sound familiar? But he is suffering as much as the kids that act out. What knowledge can you provide for me so that my son not only learns the basic but social skills also? School will be starting soon. I would like to be prepared. Thanks for any help. And she also says, my son cries every day, and I would like to know if a lot of other kids experience this as well. He cries about anything, and he does not sleep well because he is so afraid. I would like to know if this is a pattern for other kids with Asperger's.
Well, having sleeping issues is definitely a pattern for other kids with Asperger's. And possibly why he's crying is because part of what's happening is he's reliving, you know, that video in his head is replaying as he's starting to go to sleep. And it sounds like there's a lot of anxiety. It may not be crying out of sadness as much as it's becoming, that's where the physicalness of the emotion is coming out and the replaying of what's happened for him at school. Tony Atwood, who I've quoted before, says that for a lot of these kids, going to high school is equivalent of post-traumatic stress that one would have from being in the Vietnam War. I mean, there are some kids that the large, comprehensive high school campus is too much for them to be able to overcome some of the anxieties that are going to allow them to learn all that they need to learn at school. And so if he's that anxious, I really feel it's important to talk to a healthcare provider or a counselor at that school and find out what they can do to try to alleviate that kind of a stress. I'm concerned about this one in particular. And I hope
right.
You have some resources at your school, healthcare provider, behavioral health provider, whatever, to help to alleviate some of those things because it just sounds like a challenging situation.
And
yeah.
And would it have the size of the school does make a difference, Cynthia? I mean, do you feel
absolutely.
That?
Absolutely.
I mean, I know when I knew, I have two very different sons, and when my older son, you know, could handle the 3,000-kid high school that we have here at Torrey Pines, but I started looking for a smaller high school when Ben was in middle school, you know, even elementary school. I started thinking, okay, I should send him to San Diego Academy. There was only 1,400 kids there, you know, and if that didn't work of that large, I was even thinking of, you know, possibly a private school if I had to, but I really believe in public education, so I didn't want to. And fortunately, we did have this new high school open up that is 1,400 kids, you know, so he's doing fine because of the smaller, but I know Ben would have done, I don't think he would have handled the 3,000-kid school. So that's something else parents could look at is it possible to do an inter-district transfer?
Or a charter school. Sometimes
there's a
smaller charter school. Here in San Diego, we have High Tech High, which is a charter school.
I thought of that one, too, for Ben, mm-hmm. Yes.
And that's been very successful for these kinds of kids where it's the size of the campus that causes the initial anxiety, and then you add to that all the other stuff that's kind of going on. So what area was this person in, Chantal?
I think it was Torrance, wasn't it?
I'm sorry, I moved to start reading another question.
Okay.
To make sure that I was ready.
Yeah. So I really would want that. I really would want that parent to look at what are some of her resources.
It was foreign. Yeah, that's what I thought.
So Ella Nelson, if you're listening, please email to Cynthia. Are you going to give an email again to your office staff?
Yes, definitely.
Will you give the email now? So if she's listening,
I'm sorry. Unfortunately, I've got the window open. Cynthia@casefamily.com.
So it's Cynthia, CYNTHIA,
yes.
@casefamily.com.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. All right, here's a question from Bonnie Sayers in Los Angeles. I have to say, Bonnie Sayers is someone who is a real advocate for people with autism. I saw her last weekend at a conference in Pasadena. She actually has a blog site, which I don't remember the name of, but she's always giving out lots of information to parents, and she also is on tweets. You can go look for her there. But she has a question for you. My high-functioning autism teen has been homeschooled for middle school years, entering eighth grade, wants to go to high school, needs to prepare for that process. He perseverates on animals. Is there a way to teach him to limit this conversation topic to a few minutes and move on, or can only talk about at home? And before you respond to that, I did want to mention that a couple people have written in on here, and I'm sure, as you well know from your work, there are tons of kids with Asperger's that are removed from school and homeschooled because of what they have to put up with in the school systems and the bullying and so on. So it's really hard, especially when people want to make the change from homeschooling back into the school system or trying to give them the social experiences they need. So besides answering her question, I was wondering if you could respond to that as well. So I'm going to remind you of her question is, he needs to prepare to go to high school after being homeschooled for the middle years. He perseverates on animals, and is there a way to teach him to limit this conversation topic to a few minutes and move on, or to only talk about that at home?
I think we go back to what we were talking about just in the prior question about looking for alternatives, charter schools, smaller high school campus that might be available in a parent choice situation, especially in California. Those are some options. I think that what you're looking at is going from homeschooling. Some of the answers I don't have about this question is he in a homeschooling only where he's only been at home, or has it been a homeschool, been a center setting? Because down here in San Diego, we have some homeschooling where they actually go to a center and have classes for part of their week, so they still have that social environment and that larger group environment. That's a nice step to going on to a campus. But again, we get back to the fundamental thing that I see for a lot of these teens, especially ones that have been pulled out and homeschooled, is what is the size of the campus you're going to? And it's not just the amount of kids that are there, but the size of the campus that has to be navigated for that individual. So if they have to...
But do you have any specific information to give her on how to teach him to limit his conversation topic? Is there like a behavioral strategy, for example?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And we've talked about it already. There's visuals that you can do. There's the concrete, putting it in the box. There's the limiting. Can you get 2 minutes? And I'm going to time you. And when the 2 minutes is up, we're done talking about this. There's the first complete whatever it is that he needs to complete, then you can have 2 minutes of your talk. I mean, you can use that special interest in so many different ways behaviorally to get at what you're trying to get at. Absolutely.
And in the book, there's a chapter on obsessions. There's a chapter, you know, because they're such visual thinkers, you know, that there's the writing it down. There's, you know, all that kind of thing. Throughout the book, it's kind of addressed.
I've had a few people email in some questions right here, all of them asking for the name of your book and your website. And I do want to tell people I will again repeat them at the end in a half an hour, but I will repeat it now for those of you who are asking on the edge of your seats, waiting to find out. It's called Quirky Yes, Hopeless No, Practical Tips to Help Your Child with Asperger's Syndrome Be More Socially Accepted. And it's written by Cynthia Labre-Noral and with Beth Wagner-Brust. Someone also asked for the website. Do you want to give the website, Cynthia?
Yes. The website for my book is www.
I'd spell it. Spell it out.
Yeah. I'm going to.
Okay.
Cynthia.
Well, no, spell that too, though.
Okay. Let me start again. www.cynthiaorall.com. Information on the book. It's got excerpts from the book, where you can order the book. It's in Barnes & Noble if you're on the West Coast. Amazon.com has it online. And also a lot of resources are now on that website and any events that we're going to be having speaking.
Okay, great. Here's another question from Holly in Clinton. My son is 7 and very anxious when he comes home from school. Any suggestions for me? He is very sensory and hates to be talked to or touched. Any way I can help him?
Okay, a great suggestion is when he's just come home from school, that's when, as we've talked earlier, that's when he's held it all together and he needs probably 20 to 30 minutes of some of his time to decompress, whatever it is that he enjoys doing, but it needs to be put on a schedule so he understands when he comes home, that's what he gets, and a timer is set. Whatever that sensory might be getting, crawling underneath the pillows, it might, you know, have something heavy on him, because even though he doesn't like to be touched, doesn't mean that he doesn't like deep pressure. It might be swinging because he's more of a vestibular kind of kid. So if he's getting treated by an occupational therapist, ask that occupational therapist what kinds of things that he or she sees that your son uses to calm himself. And those are the kinds of things that you need to allow for about that 20, 30 minutes right when he comes home from school. But don't let it go too long, because then you're going to have him go into that isolative stage where it's like, okay, now I'm not going to leave the house again. I'm home. I'm not going to leave. And then you get into that whole thing of, you know, we want to do things after school. We want to do things as a family. And he would rather just be alone. So be very careful about limiting that time and letting him know you have 20 minutes of your time, whatever you want to call it, and then go on with whatever's going to be the activity. And I suggest when you go to transition from that sensory time, use it with a written schedule, a visual strategy, not just talking to him, okay, now you should be done with your alone time, but use that written schedule so it helps him to make that transition in that process.
Very good. Here's a question from a preschool teacher, Vanessa Rossell in West Palm Beach. Hi, I am a preschool teacher and work with a 5-year-old that has special needs, though he has not been formally diagnosed. He's seen a speech therapist twice a week, but beyond that, his parents do not want to hear that there is atypical behavior. When I ask him a question, he often repeats whatever I say or does not respond. Another thing he does is when I ask him something like, do we hit another friend, he responds yes. Well, you asked a question, you got an answer. What do you expect? Sorry, that's just my comment, not as an expert. How can I address this and help him to be successful in his social interactions with his classmates? What I have done is hold his hands while I speak to him, and that seems to help a bit. Any input is great. Thanks. So he needs help in communicating, I guess, appropriate and not appropriate behavior in terms of hitting other people.
Right. And, you know, I think if she's been listening all along, she's heard some great ideas and some strategies. I think one of the things is making sure that you slow down what you're saying to him. Not that you're talking in a lower level or, you know, like he's younger than he actually is, but that you're slowing down the information that you're getting. So if there's something important you want him to hear, that's the message you're getting. And like Beth said, you want to state what you want him to do, not what you don't want him to do. And he's a bright little guy. You asked him a question, you got an answer. So instead of asking questions that you don't know what the answer is going to be, make statements. This is what we need to be doing with our friends. We hold our hands, you know, keep our hands to our side when we're walking. We keep our hands to ourselves. All of those things, instead of saying stop running, say walk, whatever it is that you're expecting him to do. And the biggest key that I can give you, even as a preschool teacher, write it down. It might have to be in a picture, but use the written word. It's very powerful. Have a little whiteboard. Go to Walmart or Target and get yourself a little whiteboard that you can write down for him what you want him to be doing. And that is going to be key.
Those are great suggestions. It's those concrete suggestions that are so helpful. But it's funny with that question she asked, do we hit another friend? Because, you know, sometimes that kind of works with, you know, neurotypical kids. But it's just having lived in different countries with my daughter, who is neurotypical, I found out I get in a lot of trouble because in French and in English that we speak in the UK, you never tell someone, do this or do that, please. You say, would you please be so kind as to do this? So I'm forever, I was forever getting in trouble with my daughter because when we moved to the States, I was still using the polite form of asking her, and I would say, would you please be so kind as to empty the dishwasher? And she would say no. I would, because I didn't say, empty the dishwasher, please. But in France, French and in English, English, it's really rude to just give people an order. In America, we do that all the time. So it's the same kind of thing as a teacher. You're trying to make someone think by saying, oh, do we hit another friend? And then they're supposed to think, well, no, we don't. But this person really needs that extra help that you're talking about because of the way that his brain is wired.
Exactly. Exactly. More concrete and more kind of to the point. And you know what I've learned from some of the adults that I've been lucky enough to spend some time with is what they've told me is I wish people had been more concrete with me. Like when I've done a cognitive behavior therapy session, they'll say afterwards, you know, I wish I had had a counselor that was like you, that was just more to the point, gave me what I needed to do, and sent me on my merry way because I was always looking. One woman said to me, I always knew everybody else was doing something right. I just didn't know what right was. And
well, you know, it's funny. Go ahead. I was just going to say, my son doesn't have Asperger's, but he is very clear that he wants rules. So he didn't really have rules. I mean, he knows what's appropriate and inappropriate behavior, but we had set him up for a couple places where there were issues, but I always forget when you start somewhere new. And so he's been going to the gym for a year now, but it hasn't been a problem area. But we were just talking about rules because when he started going somewhere new and the person complained about Jeremy's behavior, I don't know, Jeremy was stemming or something, and Jeremy said, well, you haven't told me what the rules are. And I thought, well, yeah, that's true, because it wasn't my office. It was like a therapy office, and so I didn't feel like it was for me to set the rules. So then after we left, he said, you know, he spells this out. I need rules for everywhere. So he said, I want rules for the gym. So his rules for the gym were things like, I should always say hi to the receptionist. And then but the thing is, because he still needs a little bit of that prompting to say hi, and it's really interesting because right now we're training staff, new staff, and he will critique after the training. So how was that today? Oh, she's very nice, but you need to be more strict with me. You need to be more clear in what you expect me to do. And he really likes it when people are much clearer and what people would say, oh, that's so strict. I feel like I'm being mean. I'm like, no, you're being clear. He needs to know this is okay, this is not okay. And that's how then he can control his behaviors and his feelings.
Exactly. And to that preschool teacher, I think that that is something that happens for a lot of preschool teachers because, you're taught to be somewhat language-based and use so much language, so you're modeling that language, and what you're actually doing is confusing him. And sometimes, possibly when he is hitting other children, it has nothing to do with trying to be aggressive and intending to harm, but it can be, you're giving me way too much information. I'm not sure what I'm supposed to do with it, and my body just gets moving. So being clear with it is definitely helpful.
Well, here's a good question from, all of these are good questions, but here's one different from ones that we've had. It's from Rachel Robinson in Jasper, Tennessee. Hi, my son Devin is almost 11 and has had to experience the loss of a sibling, a grandmother, and a great-grandmother within the last 5 years. He now gets scared when we visit hospitals, doctors, etc., and asks questions about death and asks me if he is going to die because we are visiting these places. He will start asking questions about this topic, and when he doesn't understand, he asks others, even strangers. I don't think that regular counseling is the answer, but I'm not sure what to do. He was diagnosed on the moderate end of the autism spectrum at 2 and is now higher functioning, maybe even closer to Asperger's. Thanks. That's
okay,
really
great.
Tough.
Great, because, I mean, it's a great question because what you're dealing with is somewhat of a phobia because it's come along from some experience for him. So what he's done is he's replayed this video in his head, and this video includes hospitals. And then it has a very specific ending for him. And unfortunately for him, he has experienced those losses. The type of counseling that you want to get into is cognitive behavior therapy. You want to get in somewhere where somebody's going to actually address that phobia and going to give him some strategies to deal with it. Probably going to do some desensitization. I mean, I've done this with some of my clients that are afraid of dogs, for example, and are afraid of other kinds of things, loud cars and noises and that. So you're going to work with somebody that's going to be able to give some systematic steps to work through this anxiety that he has.
Very good.
And hopefully he's going to be able to go to hospital, and he's going to be able to get that understanding and that logic that hospitals are also places where people get well and that help people. And that's the other piece that I would want that cognitive behavior therapist to be working on.
Right. Here's a question or a comment from Jerry Absher from Carlsbad.
Ooh.
My son has been a member of the Friends Club for several years, and he has benefited from it. He is now of middle school age and has yet to find that one friend that was mentioned several minutes ago. I wrestle with the decision of just letting things happen in their own time versus trying additional strategies to have my son experience the feeling of having a best friend before he reaches adulthood. Any comments?
Do you want to take that one, Beth?
Well, no.
I have to think about it. Because you're the one that talked about the one friend. I know this individual, and I think the main thing is looking again for where he can connect with other kids that have similar interests to him. And it might be going to, and I know Beth's son started going to a cyber store.
Yeah, computer store, right.
Where he connected with some other kids. We do something here and we'll do several times a year, a LAN party where the kids come in and we have so many different game systems. Not enough, as many kids are here, so they have to practice all that waiting turns and that. And sometimes when I come in and see the kids doing the LAN party, it's like they're all typical kids. I mean, they're just interacting just in a very wonderful fashion. I think finding that one friend, it isn't something that your son is going to go do by himself. It's going to take that the gentle prodding and sometimes that, no, first you're going to do this, then you're going to do this before that connection is going to be made, because it's not something that he's necessarily going to go seek out on his own. But I think when it does happen, I think it's, as Beth has said earlier, it's really nice because then he has that added, and he's generalized what he's learned here in Friends Club, he's got that added sense of accomplishments and some success as well. You have to be careful on the other side. I do want to say this, that sometimes when that first friendship is sometimes formed, it becomes almost a part of an obsession itself, and they can almost suffocate the friend. So you have to kind of set some parameters, and I like Chantal's talk, Jeremy wanting to know some of the rules, so there might also be some written ideas of what to do when you are with that friend that's going to go into that piece of it.
Yeah, I am ready to speak about to this, actually, at this point. And that is that Ben actually made his first friend in the three-year-old class at preschool. And it was with a girl. And her name was Courtney. And she loved dinosaurs. And she loved Legos. And she was not your typical little girl, you know, with her interests. Anytime they got together to play, I could walk away and they would come back 2 hours later and they were as happy as clams, you know, still working. This is from 3-year-old preschool all the way to about fourth grade. And then the boy-girl thing started, you know, becoming more obvious at school. And actually in about second or third grade, Courtney started getting teased because Ben was her friend. Ben still hadn't really realized Courtney was a girl. It just didn't really, you know, he didn't make that kind of distinction. You know, he didn't care. She was his friend. And so then he was really at a loss in fifth and sixth grade because at that point Courtney was a grade ahead of him. And so, he didn't have Courtney anymore, and he didn't quite click with any of the boys in his class because he wasn't athletic. So even though we tried the 1 year of T-ball back in kindergarten, he wasn't playing T-ball. You know, he couldn't talk sports with the kids. He did play soccer because I realized that soccer is a very forgiving sport. And no matter, and I also coached his team, but anyone can play soccer. And with Ben not being very adept at the hand-eye coordination, the foot-eye coordination was fine. And so, and he made a terrific defensive player. We called him the wall, and he's in our book because that's what, the example of him. He could stop any ball. He didn't really know what to do with it other than kick it forward, you know. I mean, he wouldn't have made a good forward or a halfback, but he was fine as a defender. So anyway, but the problem is by fifth or sixth grade, other boys were more seriously into sports. And at that point, Ben was kind of phasing out of the sports thing. And so fortunately, by the time he went to middle school in seventh grade, he met this wonderful fellow named Nigel, and they became great friends because they were the two who figured out in PE, if you hide behind the girls in dodgeball, they make a great wall because they're standing there talking. And so it took a couple of tries for me to get Ben to get his phone number. And even when he brought the phone number, I said, okay, great. Now what's his name? And he said, I don't know, because he'd forgotten to ask his name. So it takes coaching for them to try to, you know, even just get the basics of a name, a phone number, and then tip me calling the parents to try to get them together, even in seventh grade, you know, taking the first steps and continuing to get them together through seventh and eighth and ninth. And then a tragedy happened, and when they were in 10th grade, Nigel was in a tragic accident, and he died. And that has been a struggle these last few years for Ben, because he lost, as he said, his friend in a million. He keeps saying Nigel was one in a million. And so here he had found this perfect friend where Nigel didn't have Asperger's, but he had dysgraphia and some other things, and they just both met on a certain plane where they both were in the world of imagination, and they had a similar sense of humor, and they, as Ben said, we forgive each other our annoying behaviors, you know, and they really had clicked, and the way he and Courtney had clicked earlier, but here it was a boy, which made him feel better, because he also got the sense in about fifth or sixth grade that he was supposed to have a boy as a friend and not a girl. So in these last couple of years, it's been hard for him to find a new friend. And it's great that Cynthia mentioned the LAN parties, these local area networks. What we used to do is go to the cyber store where they had these computers that were all connected together. And I would take different friends with Ben because that's the one thing they could connect on in the hopes of him being able to find another friend. You know, and they always gave them something to talk about when we came away from there. But in the course of helping with an Eagle Scout project at the high school, Ben did meet these other kids where they now have been having LAN parties together at home, and it takes though me hosting, you know, it's rotated, but I've tried to host it at least once a month so that they come to us. And Ben has gotten better and better at being a host by having them at our house, and I just make sure we have lots of food to, you know, and lots of things to drink, and I bake something so the house smells great. And I was the only one who figured out that if we made a list of their names, their phone numbers, and their emails, as soon as, then they could all contact each other, not just when school was in session, but even through the summer when they wouldn't see each other at school. And each one of them, when they wrote their names down, said, what a great idea. And it never would have occurred to any of them because all of them were quirky, you know, but we got about eight of them together on and off, and it's been wonderful. And now some of them have graduated because they're seniors, and there are about four who are juniors. And Ben just yesterday was saying, when I was saying, okay, school's going to start in a week, and this will be good, you'll be a senior. And he kind of said, yeah. And he was sad. And I said, well, what's wrong, Ben? He goes, well, I'm starting over. And that meant that he, you know, he felt like he'd lost a number, that there at least five of them were seniors, and now they're going on to college. And I pointed out, well, there was still Travis, and there's still Will and Will, these other fellows who are now going to be seniors with him. And I said, at lunchtime, you'll just have to start up and try to find out who's interested in a LAN party. And then maybe you can build up again, you know, and have that happen. So,
these are really good examples of how it doesn't matter how many resources or what you have at the school. It still is, as a parent, really important to be involved to a certain extent, even if you can't be at the school or whatever. But, you know, those off hours,
it's hard
to think about that, because I, you know, as our kids get older, we get older too. And so we're tired. We don't have the energy we used to have 20 years ago. But we still have to have that energy to help the kids as their teenagers get out there and make the connections.
Absolutely. And again, it's one of our chapters in the book, Initiative. These guys do not take the initiative. And we have a chapter on phone skills. Ben's incredibly awkward on the phone. I literally, I'm training him to dial the number at least, so he's more comfortable doing that. But we talk about what are you going to say before you dial. And then when he gets on, he's usually thrown because it's not the person he wants to talk to or he forgets. And I do hover at the doorway or I'm in the hallway, so I sort of listen to how the conversation's going. And if he's leaving out some details or, you know, he seems flummoxed, you know, he can't tell what he's supposed to do next, I kind of coach from the sidelines just to help him get through the phone call. But
what about a list? A list help?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, yeah, and, you know, I am bad about that. I mean, I need to write things down more often for Ben, although he's never asked for it, and of course they don't. They don't ask for help. That's another chapter in the book. And having written this chapter on writing things down, I realized, oh man, that's something I haven't done as much with Ben, and I need to, especially now that he's older. And he does respond to the list. But
hey,
in a phone call.
I'm sorry, I don't want to cut you off, but we have so many questions. We only have 10 minutes.
Sure.
So now we have really short answers, okay?
Yeah.
Here, Terry. Baton Rouge, Louisiana. My 21-year-old son with AS interrupts in conversations constantly. When asked to wait his turn, he complains that he is afraid that he will forget the thoughts. And that actually does happen when we insist that he waits. By the time someone has finished their thought, he can't remember what he wanted to input and he is very frustrated. How can we get him to stop interrupting but yet also remember his thoughts?
Well, again, writing it down, maybe having some type of a tape recorder that he can tape record into if he is auditory and can remember it after that. I'm trying to go quick here so that we can get more questions answered. I think we've talked for the last couple of hours about a lot of really good strategies on how to get that down. One of the things that I learned from a young man who was having similar difficulties is we had to kind of teach him about, we had to use some sensory strategies to help him slow his body down and his mind down, because what was happening is the thoughts were racing and the actual anxiety was that he was going to forget something. And so for him, it was very powerful to teach him some strategies, just kind of calm his body, taking some breaths, and, you know, you got a 21-year-old you're dealing with, so you want to teach him some things that, you know, are going to be kind of at his motivational level, using maybe his special interest, something that he can think about to help get calm, because until he does that, he's not going to be able to take the time to get those thoughts down, whether they're on paper or recorded.
Right. Okay, now here's Dee from Little Rock. She doesn't say how old her son is, but she says, my son has problems with boundary issues. He always has to be hovering over someone or right up in someone's face, which makes him sort of annoying to other children and adults. He has been told and taught for years, but nothing helps. Clingy just seems to be who he is.
Oh, okay. Again, I would want to use some visual strategies. I would want to work. Somewhere along the line, we've got to break the behavioral sequence that we have here. And the clinginess may be coming from a sensory, you know, from some type of a sensory need that's being met. But at the same time, now we've developed a behavioral sequence. And this is what we do. So this and this and this goes together, and this is what I do, and I can kind of depend on a pattern from others to do this for me or to do this with me. And so I'm looking at this a bit with behaviorist eyes and going, what can we do to break this pattern? What do I need to do regarding depending upon the age and the ability of this young man? We need to figure out ways to come up with some strategies so that he's not being quite as clingy.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That makes sense.
Yes, it does. Here's B. Baker from Flintstone. What's the best way for a teen girl with Asperger's to deal with bullying from other teenage girls at school? That's a loaded question. I mean, it's a huge question.
To deal with bullying at school?
Correct, from other teenage girls.
Well, it's a shame of the gender, too. Girls can be the worst. You know what? I do think that there's some good resources. We use a lot of books on bullying in what we do in Friends Club. That is listed. All of the books that we use in Friends Club is listed on that website, www.cynthianorrell.com. And there's a couple of different books about dealing with bullies if she's good at, if she likes to read and get information from that. There's some good movies out there and some resources that we've used to help understand. Because number one, we go through this, there's quite an extensive chapter on bullying in our book.
Right.
Because number one, they have to recognize when they're being taken advantage of. And that's key for the females, because that's what's happening, is there's looks, there's smirks, there's things that's happening with those girls that they're giving each other messages that this young girl with Asperger's is not picking up on. And that's the key of what she needs to learn. And I would, if she's motivated, I would watch movies like Mean Girls and some of those other movies where there's great examples of the bullying, and replay that back for her and take it apart and say, here's what's going on, here's the look, can you recognize when it's mean teasing versus friendly teasing? Because she, if she's asking for it, for the help, that means that she's going to be motivated to take that information in and use it so that she's not bullied. But with all of that said, somebody has to inform the school that the bullying is going on.
Correct.
The school has to take a stand on this. Way too many times, Carol Gray talks about this. I mentioned in some of Carol Gray's original work on bullies, we mentioned it in our book, an adult has to step in and intervene. And I don't care what the adult says about the implications of that. An adult has to step in and intervene.
Right. And this brings up a couple questions have come in. It's not related, but it is a bit. When should you tell your child that they have Asperger's? Now, I know this is kind of a loaded question because I meet parents all around the country. Some of them are upfront about their kids having Asperger's. Others don't want the school to know or don't want the peers to know. What are your thoughts on that, and when is it the proper time to tell your child?
Okay,
we have a chapter titled that.
We have a whole chapter on it, but I'm
when to tell your child.
All right, but right now you only have a few minutes.
Right, and but I'm gonna I want to address it this way.
Okay.
Typical kids pick up the differences in other kids by the age of 2 or 3. So even though you don't want to announce it to anybody, other kids have already picked up on it by the time your child's in elementary school. Your child's already targeted. So, you know, and I understand where parents are coming from, and my easy answer to say to this is, when you are ready to use the word autism or Asperger's syndrome yourself, it's time to tell your child. And I like that by the age of 9, we're talking about it. And it doesn't have to be, here's the definition of Asperger's syndrome. It's, hey, there's people thinkers and there's thing thinkers. And these are the different ways that people are wired, because they're already noticing that they're different because of the way that they're interacting with other kids. So I know families, you know, have a hard time with using the A word, and I'm with them there, and I understand. At the same time, your child's already been targeted by other kids as being different.
Okay, now, Beth, in a couple of minutes only, can you tell me your point of view as a parent?
About
the letting your child know he or she has Asperger's. At what age did you do it, and what's your opinion?
Well, Ben had been diagnosed with ADD, the inattentive type, ADHD, but the inattentive type, so he wasn't hyper, but he was diagnosed with that in kindergarten, and there's a 60% comorbidity of ADD, so that's often the one that is spotted first. And then in third grade, when he was 9 years old, just as Cynthia said, that's when his ADD doctor said, you know, I think your son has Asperger's. And I'm saying, what's that, you know? And then, again, Quirky Yes, Hopeless No is the book I wish I had at that point, you know. So that
right. When did you tell your son? That's the question.
So I'm trying. I know. So then when he started the Friends Club, I told him then, which was, you know, was 6 months later, you know, in fourth grade when he started, I explained that this is why he was going to it. And he never had a problem, and I didn't dwell on it. I didn't, you know, constantly say Asperger's, Asperger's, Asperger's. I just had said, you know, there are people that, you know, just what Cynthia said, who need help with people skills, you know, and so this will be helpful for you. And I think I presented it more that way. Just that this will help you with people skills. This will help you get along with other kids. And then in about seventh grade probably is when I actually had said Asperger's, you know, the word more often. But we checked the box, the autism box, in sixth grade when he had an IEP. Before he went into junior high, I wanted to make sure he'd had an IEP that that was thorough. And so they did one at the elementary school before he was going, because for us, that's the end of elementary school, and then junior high school starts in seventh grade or middle school. And so it was important to have that designation then, and we had no qualms about checking it because we knew then he would get the services he needed, or at least the accommodations he needed for high school and for tests and all the rest of it. And I saw no reason to hide it. I saw no reason to not acknowledge it because I only saw it as helpful. You know, I'm so grateful we have a label for Ben and that he's not one of the unknowns, because that would be so frustrating not to know
right.
What's wrong.
So, Cynthia, someone here was asking, Linda Warner from Garden City, Missouri. Her son is 7.5. And do you have any books that are child-friendly to help explain Asperger's to him?
There are a couple of books. There's a book called Asperger's Huh, H-U-H, and that is written for children. There's a book we have here in our office that was written by one of our clients. It's called This is Asperger's, and it is a good one for a child to read for themselves. It's also a very good one for siblings to read. I'm looking on my bookshelf right now. And here's another one called, this is a good one. It's called I'm Utterly Unique. And it's by Elaine Marie Larson. And it's celebrating the strengths of children with Asperger's syndrome and high-functioning autism. And it would be great for a 7-year-old. That's one that we use.
Can you just spell out the title one more time, and then
yes.
We're going to have
I am Utterly, U-T-T-E-R-L-Y, Unique,
okay.
By Elaine Marie Larson. And it's on Amazon.com.
Okay. So I wanted to remind the listeners that my guests this evening on MomsFightingAutism.com have been Cynthia Labrea Noral and Beth Wagner Bruss, who co-authored a book that is called Quirky Yes, Hopeless No, Practical Tips to Help Your Child with Asperger's Syndrome Be More Socially Accepted. Cynthia, will you give me the website once again for the book and for your services?
For the book is www.cynthianoral, that's N as in Nancy, O-R-A-L-L, .com, and website to find out more about my services, in particular Friends Club, is www.case, C-A-S as in Sam, efamily.com. And
okay,
you can also just Google Quirky Yes, Hopeless No, and it will take you to both of those websites.
Okay, and Beth, could you please give us the website for your author website?
Oh, well, if people are interested, this is my first adult book, so I have 13 children's books, and a website is mostly pertaining to those, and it's just my name. And so it's www.bethbrust, BethBrust.com.
Great.
But it also has a blurb about Quirky on it, as well as about my children's book.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you both for having been guests this evening. I wanted to ask those who have been listening if they would please call and leave their comments. I'm going to give you a phone number. It's really important to have comments so that we know, first of all, how you have enjoyed the guests, how you have enjoyed or not the moderating skills, and also if there are topics that you would like to hear, but especially how what you've liked about the webinars that you have listened into. So here's the phone number to call in your comments. It's 877-211-0212, and then you press 1, the number 1, back. Again, 877-211-0212, and press 1 to leave feedback. My next webinar for MomsFightingAutism.com will be on September 14th. My guest will be Blaise Ginsberg, who is the author of Episodes, My Life as I See It. And it's a young adult with Asperger's who writes about his teen years and what it is like, again, his life as he sees it. So it's going to be mostly about adolescent issues on Monday, September 14th. So thank you all for listening. Thank you again to my guests.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for having us.
Until next time, be the change that you want to see. Good night now from MomsFightingAutism.com. Thank you.